Hello and welcome back to the Neurotransmitters, a podcast about everything related to clinical neurology. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Kentris, and I am joined today by Lori Harada, who is an experienced nurse in the apheresis or apheresis field. Lori, tell us a little bit about your background and kind of what led you into that field of medicine.
So I'm a registered nurse, as you said. I've been in nursing for more than 35 years, but I got into apheresis by starting the apheresis or collection department at St. Louis University Hospital back in the late 80s. And what apheresis is to separate blood and to remove different components of blood. And so we can do this in many different ways, but it's usually done with a large centrifuge or a device that has a centrifuge in it to separate each blood component out. And we separate by specific gravity. But how I got into it was I had lost my brother to cancer, and the oncologist wanted to start a transplant program for a cancer therapy. And to do that, you needed an apheresis department. And at the time, I was working in the open heart intensive care unit at St. Louis University Hospital. And I said, sure, why not? Well, I need a change. And I had no idea what I was getting into. But it led me down a path that I have stayed in for over 35 years in therapeutic apheresis, cancer therapy, stem cell transplant, the whole variety of things that you can do with apheresis.
Now, particularly interested from kind of the autoimmune neurologic perspective, you know, the classic entities that are going back, like myasthenia gravis, and we also see it in the past for things like some cases of Guillain-Barré, even multiple sclerosis, or things in the kind of demyelinating sphere. So in your clinical practice over the last several decades, what has been the shift? You know, it is one of those things where it's a lot of times in neurology, well, we think it's autoimmune, but we're not quite sure. We don't necessarily have an antibody to put the name to it. So as a neurologist, we're like, well, let's do some plasmapheresis, plasma exchange. What goes into that from the back end, you know, after we like give a call to your department?
So when a call comes in to say, hey, we have this patient that has a neuromuscular disorder, whether it be any of the ones that you had described, and we want to try therapeutic apheresis, TPE is what we call it, TPE, on this patient. And so the first step is, okay, where is the patient? How acute is the patient? You know, in the situation of Guillain-Barré, which you mentioned, they can be very debilitated and on a ventilator when we finally get the call, because lots of times these neuromuscular diseases are difficult to diagnose. As you said, you don't know if they're autoimmune, you don't know, you know, what's going on. And there's been a lot of research in the last 35 years about how to treat these different diseases. And the American Society for Apheresis, we call it ASPA, has guidelines on all these different diseases. But back to your original question was, what happens? What's the next step? Well, first we have to assess the patient for vascular access, because we need to gain access to their bloodstream, because that's where we get the blood to separate the plasma off, right? And in most cases, using a centrifugal apheresis device, not a membrane separation, but centrifugal, you don't need as high of flow rates. So you can do this procedure peripherally if the patient has decent peripheral veins. You need to have access to a vein that would be able to manage at least an 18 gauge needle or IV catheter. With that, and the other thing is, you need two good veins, one in each arm. So some patients have this, some patients don't. That's really the first step, is to assess, okay, what kind of vascular access do we have with this patient, or do we need to put a central line in of some sort? The other question we ask is, what are the orders? How many plasma volumes do you want to remove? Now, when we think about a plasma volume, we look at the whole blood, and to make the math simple, if our hematocrit is 50%, that means we have 50% red cells and 50% plasma. One plasma volume would be removing 50% of their total blood volume in plasma. So, how much do you want to remove? Most orders run between 1 and 1.5 plasma volumes, which could be anywhere from 3 to 4 liters of plasma that would be removed. Then the next question is, what do you want to replace it with? Because we're doing an exchange. So we're taking the plasma off, and at the same time, we're replacing with some sort of replacement fluid. And that typically, depending on the disease, is either albumin or fresh frozen plasma. You mentioned Guillain-Barré. Guillain-Barré is typically replaced with fresh frozen plasma. But other disease, neuromuscular diseases, you can use albumin. So it just depends on what the disease is. And going back to that ASPA guidelines, I actually happen to have one of the books right here in front of me. And this one is from 2016. They published in seven in 19. They come out every 3 years. In 19, and it doubled in size. And then there's another one coming out this year that I can't wait to see because they categorize each disease based on four categories, 1, 2, 3, and 4. One is that is the treatment of choice, therapeutic plasma exchange or red blood cell exchange. That's the treatment of choice. And then it goes down from there. When you get to category four, it's when all else fails, euphoresis kind of situation. There's not a lot of studies that say this is what you need to be doing. We tried it, it worked, and let's try it again. That's the kind of situation. But it's a great guideline to follow in the neurology world because a lot of neurologists don't understand apheresis and what the benefit is. When we remove that plasma, we remove the disease mediator causing that plasma, whether it's IgG or IgM or some sort of antibodies that are causing the issues. With a one plasma volume exchange, we can remove roughly 63% of those disease mediators that are causing the symptoms. Now, TPE is not curative, it's an adjunct to therapy. So it's a way to help the patient recover some and get back some of their functionality. And then use other chemotherapeutic agents or other medicines to control the disease. So, for example, in MS or myasthenia gravis, they may come in every 2 or 3 weeks and get exchanged as part of their routine for maintenance of their disease.
Now, anecdotally, have you now? I know one of the things that we are seeing a lot in like kind of the neuroimmunology sphere over the last 5, 10 years is this real explosion, like you said, of chemotherapeutic or immune modulating different medications. Are you seeing any shift in the patient population that is coming in for apheresis treatments?
So we're seeing a lot more neuromuscular diseases being treated with therapeutic plasma exchange or gene therapy, where we take their stem cells out, they're manipulated with gene therapy, turned into various fighting cells, and then given back to the patient. So not just plasma exchange, but the whole realm of apheresis is growing and expanding exponentially over the last 10 years.
Now, as far as the stem cell piece, is that mostly in the context of like research trials and things like that?
Well, the stem cell piece has been around for probably 30 to 40 years in stem cell transplant in treating cancer, especially hematologic disorders like leukemia, lymphoma, myeloma, those hematologic disorders, stem cell transplant has been really the curative factor. In the last 10 years, there's been a new therapy called chimeric antigen receptor T cell therapy, or CAR T. And with CAR T, it's been curative, where transplant therapy 30 or 40 years ago would get you into remission. You may have 5 years, 10 years of remission, and then your cancer was back. Right now, what we're seeing with CAR T therapy is they are being cured. And that's a big word, cured. It's not coming back. And it's exciting because you're seeing these children that come down with leukemia and they live a normal, healthy life and not have to worry about the leukemia coming back because they're cured. So CAR T is a big, big new research area. Also, gene therapy is a big.
It's interesting. You mentioned some of these new oncologic medications, right? So like the CAR Ts, the checkpoint inhibitors, things like that. Because one of the things on the neuro side, and I remember seeing this for the first time when I was in residency a few years back now, but that because they just started getting a lot of traction more widespread for like melanoma and things like that, which, like you said, we didn't really have treatments for those sorts of things that were very effective. And we are starting to see cases of Guillain-Barré. In the last year, I can recall one case of like a paraneoplastic myasthenia gravis that developed after checkpoint inhibitor therapy, and then even just in the last couple of months, someone with paraneoplastic cerebellar degeneration, also who had just recently been initiated on these immune modulating chemotherapy drugs. So it is interesting that we are seeing a little bit of a change in some of the presentation of these kind of traditional paraneoplastic entities, which we still do. I always think of like three primary treatments, steroids, IVIG, and plasmapheresis, plasma exchange. And as you probably know, right, the most common one, or I should say the one with probably most data would be like Guillain-Barré, where they've done head-to-heads and was like, well, they're about the same. And one of the problems we always run into is, it's a lot easier to get IVIG started, say, in someone who might be in a little bit more of an acute stage, just because, vascular access isn't as much of an issue. Some people who have more severe cases of Guillain-Barré, where they are developing some autonomic instability with fluctuations in blood pressure, plasmapheresis might be a little dicey, which that is a question I would like to ask you, actually, because you did mention, like, obviously there's different flows and rates and things like that. So let's say we have someone in the ICU, who's on a ventilator, who has been having lots of tachycardia, blood pressure instability. How does that affect the approach? Like, let's say maybe they got clotting disorder. We don't want to give them IVIG or whatever the reason might be. They've had immune reactions to like the first dose, but we can't keep giving it to them. How would we approach plasmapheresis in a patient like this?
Well, and we used to call it autonomic hyperreflexia, is what you were describing. And it in Guillain-Barré patients, it can be very tricky to pick up on this autonomic hyperreflexia, especially if they're on a ventilator and they can't talk to you. So monitoring the patient is so important to be in tune to, yes, what's happening with your device, but you need to pay attention to your patient and monitor their blood pressure, their respirations, their, all the basic physical assessment of what's going on. And then if you see that something is happening, you pause the system, you pause it, and you stop and let the patient recover from that autonomic incident.
Gotcha. In my own, again, anecdotal experience, most sessions are around 4 hours. Is that accurate?
It could be 2 to 4. It depends on your vascular access, how fast you can flow, and as I said before, the number of plasma volumes you're exchanging. Most of the time, you're exchanging 1 to 1.5 plasma volumes, which could be 3 liters of plasma. Now, it could be that it only takes an hour and a half to do it. It just depends on the patient condition, how fast you can flow, many different factors in managing the device itself.
Gotcha.
But it's unless you don't have good flow, I have never seen it go as long as 4 hours for a plasma exchange. Usually it's somewhere around the 1.5 to 2 hour mark at the most.
Gotcha. So I know we've been talking a little bit more about kind of on the acute side of things. And one of the points you had mentioned earlier, people will be coming in sometimes on a regular basis every three, four, even longer sometimes interval-wise, depending on their clinical response. What does that look like on the patient side of things? What kind of vascular access do they have to maintain? What are the considerations they have to keep in mind on the long-term side?
So on the long-term side, on the chronic side versus the acute side, on the chronic side, if they have good peripheral veins and they're coming in, say, once a month, that's easy enough to access peripherally. And you have less risk of systemic infection. When you have a central line, I personally call it the white tube of death because it's directly into your central vascular system. And if the nurses are not diligent in taking care of that access, then you can easily develop an infection or a thrombosis, even at the end of that catheter, that in the end causes more damage than just doing the procedure itself. So, back to your original question, what can the patient expect? Well, if it's long term, there are many different long term vascular access options. Sure, there's peripheral if they've got great veins. As we know, those veins wear out, right? Some places will put in, if it's long term, put in a AV fistula, like what is used in dialysis. And you can use an AV fistula for a therapeutic plasma exchange procedure as well. You can also put ports in, so ports that are just under the skin. And the great thing about the centrifugal device that I'm most familiar with, which is the SpectroOptia, we have single needle options for plasma exchange. So you don't need to have two, you can get away with just one. Therefore, if you only have one good vein in one arm, we can do a single needle exchange versus dual needle, which is great. It saves on sticking the patient. The time difference, as long as you can maintain good flow in a good vein, the time difference is relatively incidentally longer. It's not significantly longer. Some people will cap their inlet flow rates and it will double the time when you do a single needle procedure. But if you don't cap that flow rate and let the system run as it is designed, then there's not much difference in a single needle versus a double needle time.
Gotcha. And yeah, that's an excellent point actually, 'cause I'm very familiar more with like you said, people with ports, central lines, things like that. Again, just because like you said, some of the patients we're treating are on the older side and they don't have good peripheral access, so it does become a bit of a sticking point when we talk about, well, we're doing sessions every 4 weeks for 1 to 2 days, and they just don't have the peripheral
They
access
don't have the
to
vein.
sustain that kind of treatment. So this is something I'm not familiar with. Tell me a little bit more about these one versus two site transfusions.
The single needle versus dual needle procedure. So, in a dual needle procedure, the blood comes out of one arm, goes into the centrifuge, is separated, and we take off the plasma, the replacement fluid's added to the red cells, and it's given back through the other. So, it's this continuous loop. In a single needle procedure, we pull the blood off, and on our device, there is a reservoir that we fill up. And we're still processing the blood in the centrifuge and separating the plasma off, getting rid of the plasma. The red cells come back into the reservoir, and then the replacement fluid comes into the reservoir. When that reservoir fills up, then all the pumps that pull from the patient stop, and our one return pump turns and evacuates the reservoir, giving it back. So it's this intermittent flow back and forth through the single access.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, a little counterintuitive. Not something you would think about necessarily right out of the gate. Now, in terms of, so this is something, just in the last few months, I've been noticing, the hospital I work at, we're constantly getting alerts about shortages of various things. And
Like
I can see you shaking your head.
IVIG.
One of the things that comes up almost every week is plasma and other blood products.
Albumin.
How have you guys been handling that in your clinical practice?
Well, Michael, I am not in a clinical practice. I work for a medical device company. But what I have seen in our customers in their clinical practice is they're getting very clever in how they manage these shortages. Because right now we're seeing a shortage everywhere. If you go to try to buy a car right now, you have a year to wait if you order one. I mean,
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
it's bad. It's the supply chain is in dire straits right now. Anyway, with albumin, it comes an FFP. FFP is the fresh frozen plasma that we get from whole blood donations. And yes, whole blood donations are down. We're trying to get the word out to go and donate blood so that we have the blood supply replenished. Right now, we're running on maybe a 1 or 2 day supply. It's very critical across the
Yeah.
country, and other areas of the US are in worse situations. You know, it just depends on the metropolitan area. But in general, across the United States, there needs to be more blood donors. And what we're seeing is back in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the baby boomers were the big source of blood donations. They were dedicated donors. Now they're aging out. They're not wanting to do that donation any longer. And we're trying to get replenishment of a younger population of donors. I'm going down the donor side, and I know that's not where you wanted to go, but
That's okay. It's pertinent.
anyway, it is pertinent because that's where plasma comes from, is
Yeah.
the whole blood donation. Albumin, on the other hand, comes from plasma donations at plasma centers, and those are paid donors versus volunteer donors. So when you collect plasma from a donor, it's fractionated into all the different components that we need to treat our patients. One is albumin, the other is IVIG, the other is factor eight. I mean, there's so many different factors in the plasma that can be fractionated out. And right now, there is a shortage of albumin. Now, albumin comes in two different strengths. One is 5%, which is what's typically used in a plasma exchange as replacement fluid, 5% albumin. The other is 25% albumin. And what a lot of centers are doing when they have a shortage of 5% albumin is they take that 25% albumin and dilute it with normal saline down to 25%. And then they have their supply back reasonably. Other centers will use a combination of albumin and saline. Now you have to be careful with using too much saline because we're dealing with a crystalloid versus a colloid. Colloid is the, you know, the protein portion of the blood, which is albumin, and that's what holds everything together in our vascular system. If we take too much colloid out and replace it with saline or crystalloid, then we get these fluid shifts in the vascular system, and you can cause more damage than good because then the fluid shifts out, their blood pressure drops, their hematocrit goes up, and the patient ends up crashing. Not
Yeah,
a
that sounds like
fun.
a bad
You
state to be in.
know what I mean when I
Yes.
say crash, right? Yeah.
Yes.
So in shortages and anything plasma derived, there's a shortage right now, whether it's albumin or IVIG, there's a shortage. And it's being creative on how we can manage the patient's symptoms and manage the procedure and still use the albumin or a combination of things together to treat the patient with a plasma exchange.
Yeah, it's something I always rely on my nephrology colleagues to help manage, or I should say primarily manage, in terms of maintaining those different osmotic gradients to avoid that exact situation you're describing. And to that point, I know you mentioned that your background is a little bit more on the oncologic side of things. Like in your past, would you work primarily with oncologists or nephrologists or a little mix of the both?
Actually, a mix of the both. hematologist, oncologist, nephrologist, and neurologist, all four, because apheresis can be utilized in any one of those medical areas. You know, we think primarily hematology.
Right.
They're the ones with the most experience with the blood, right? Hematologists. But as you know, a lot of nephrologists have a combo unit in the hospital that is both renal dialysis and apheresis together because it's medical device. And there's some similarities to running a dialysis machine versus a apheresis machine, but they do different things. You know, dialysis cleans the blood versus apheresis separates the blood and removes the protein portion or the red cell portion, you know, depending on what we're trying to do. So it's important to know the distinction. And nephrologists, if they're trained appropriately, can understand the differences. The sticky wicket that we get into with nephrology is they treat it like it's dialysis, and it is not like dialysis. It is, you're dealing with plasma proteins and not just waste product in the blood.
Interesting. I've seen this one might be a little more unusual. I have encountered one pathologist who was also in charge of apheresis. Is that fairly common, or is that a
Yes,
little
yes.
unusual?
No, that can be common too. I left pathology out because it's interesting that you say that. When I started the department at St. Louis University, I was under a pathologist. Now, I worked with all the other, you know, departments, but my boss was the head of pathology and head of the blood bank. And so, yes, pathology is a common area where apheresis will reside.
Gotcha. Now, I might have missed this earlier. Did you say that were you at Washington University, St. Louis?
St. Louis University.
Oh, okay.
So there's WashU in St. Louis, and then there's St. Louis University in St. Louis.
Gotcha. I was
So
just
I
wondering
was
because I know,
with St. Louis U.
yes, Woostel, as it's colloquially known. All right. I know they're huge into the neuromuscular sphere, and I was wondering. I'm sure. Being in the same town, especially in those early days of the identification of a lot of these autoantibodies, you were probably kind of right at the epicenter for that. Would that be fair to say?
It was very interesting in the 80s what diseases we were treating and what they were coming up with just to try to relieve the symptoms of the patient. You know, as I said, when all else fails, you apheresis. And it was very interesting, and I was so glad to see the American Society for Apheresis come out with these guidelines on what diseases to treat, which one is proven to be most effective. Where are there just certain case studies that say it kind of worked? It's really a great guideline for physicians that are not well educated in the apheresis area to go and look up, okay, I've got this disease. How do I treat it? And it was funny, I was listening to one of your podcasts about stiff person
Oh,
syndrome.
yes, yeah.
And in the book, in the Bible, stiff person syndrome is considered a category three for therapeutic plasma exchange. So there's some studies that show it helps with stiff person syndrome, but it's interesting. It's in the guidelines from ASPA.
Yeah.
How about that?
That's a problem with neurology a lot, is that it is a lot of the entities are so rare that the quality of the data
Yes.
isn't, we're certainly not at the level
Not
of
good.
randomized controlled trials. So you kind of have to fall back on your pathophysiology and be like, well, there's an antibody. We can theoretically remove antibodies. So
Right?
theoretically,
Right? Theoretically,
but yeah,
yeah.
there certainly is an element of that to a lot of things. Like I've had a couple different like chronic autoimmune encephalitis in the past, things like that that didn't respond to traditional immunotherapy, or that we even do like combination chemotherapy with apheresis. Like they get the apheresis, and then they would, within a few days, get the chemotherapeutic agent to clear out the antibodies and then kind of bring down the B cell population again, like with rituximab or something similar.
Well, And that's exactly like in leukemia. You know, when a leukemic patient's in crisis, their white blood cell count is sky high. And we use apheresis to separate the blood and remove the white cells, not the plasma portion, but the white cells, and get it down to a lower level so that you can start them on chemotherapy to control that overproduction of white cells, B cells, T cells, whatever type of leukemia we're talking about, but help control that production in the bone marrow with chemotherapeutic agents.
Interesting. I do have a, this is more of a historical question. Are there any disease entities that that I should say you, back in, 20, 30 years ago in your practice that were frequently apheresed and then we over time learned, oh, we definitely shouldn't be doing that?
That's a good question, and I'm thinking if there are any diseases. We've added a lot of diseases, but have we removed any that don't respond? I don't know if I know of anything specifically that have been removed. There's been so many more added
Gotcha. And it does seem
than
to be the
removed.
trend. Like we keep
Yeah.
identifying more.
Well, and as I said, the guidelines from ASPA keeps growing and growing, and they actually change their categories from year to year. And most of the time they up the category from like a category three to a category two because there's more data. Because they look at the data, they look at the trials that are run. Are they controlled, double blind, blah, blah, blah trials that
Exactly, yeah.
are the most important trials? Or are they just case studies that people are publishing as abstracts? So they look at all the data and they evaluate every single disease and they make adjustments every 3 years to how these diseases are treated. So again, I refer any physician back to the ASPA guidelines because that's really clinical proof of what works and what doesn't.
Gotcha. And I know there's some notable exceptions, but are most neurologic entities kind of in the like the class three, class two family?
No, Guillain-Barré is class one.
Well, that was one of the exceptions, I would say. Probably that and Guillain-Barré, or that and myasthenia are probably like more in the class one family.
Exactly. They're more in the class one. I would have to look them up, but yes, probably more the neuromusculars are in class two, but it depends on what that neuromuscular disease is. Because as I said, Guillain-Barré, that's like I and personally when I was a practicing apheresis nurse, I would see treat a Guillain-Barré patient, start their plasma exchange, and by the end of it, they would be talking to me where they couldn't be talking to me before. And they would be moving. You would see just by one treatment the change in their symptoms, which is very rewarding as a nurse to see that, hey, what I'm doing is helping.
And that is one of the arguments in favor of apheresis over IVIG is that it's supposed to have a quicker onset in terms of symptom
Response.
control. So, although it's never really been fully quantified for a lot of disease states, but
Can I add one more thing about IVIG versus TPE?
sure.
Cost.
Tell me about the cost.
Now, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but the cost of IVIG is significantly higher than the cost of TPE. And that's where if you can get it faster and do it peripherally as a single needle and get the results faster than IVIG. IVIG takes a long time to infuse. It takes what, 4 hours to infuse
Assuming they
a
tolerate it
dose
well
of
without any signs of chemical
IVIG. Yeah,
meningitis
as
or
long as they
yes.
tolerate it well, all that. And with TPE, we're talking less time, we're talking faster response, and you can see it happen right there. I mean, and overall, there have been studies that show overall the cost effectiveness of TPE is less than IVIG. And depending on who's doing the TPE, whether it's in hospital department or if it's a service provider, is there are a lot of service providers across the country that provide apheresis services, and a lot of them are dialysis companies that have an apheresis arm to it. They come in with their devices and they perform, and then they charge the hospital a set fee for that procedure. And that can vary depending on which service provider is providing the service. So, but it is less than $20,000 a treatment.
Well, that's fair, and
It's
that's always good to know. You know, we do have to live in the real world where things
yeah.
cost money, especially if we're talking like about monthly treatments or things like in a chronic condition.
In a chronic state.
So you said that you're more in the medical devices side of things in your career at this stage.
Yes.
So what does that look like?
So I left active clinical practice in 1990. So I've been out of the clinical practice for a while, but what I went into was industry, and I started out teaching people how to use these devices. And that's where I still am today. I manage a team of specialists. We call them specialists at Terumo Blood and Cell Technologies. It's our team of specialists that go out and train our customers on how to use our devices. And training and learning is my passion because having someone understand what the benefits of apheresis is really exciting to me, because most of the time people, it's hocus pocus. You hook this patient up, you run their blood through, it's like an oil change or something.
Right, it's
I don't
like a old
know.
school bloodletting, right?
Yeah, it's like old school bloodletting. And it has come so far in the last 35, 40 years in technology-wise. The early devices that I used were open systems. They took a long time to set up. It's still accomplished, but today's devices are so much more streamlined and more safe for the patient and more cost-effective than some other therapies.
Would you say that a lot of the people that you're teaching, are they also dialysis nurses, or is they usually serve a dual function in their communities, especially if we're talking like smaller towns, more rural areas, things like that?
Yes, especially in rural areas, you'll see dialysis nurses be co-trained or double-trained in both apheresis and dialysis. And that's typically where we see this. Also, there are dedicated apheresis nurses, which really focus on and understand apheresis. I like those nurses the best because they don't relate it to dialysis, and there is a difference. In dialysis, we're cleaning the blood. In apheresis, we're removing proteins, and it's different. But if you look in large metropolitan areas, university hospitals, you're going to see their own apheresis department versus a combo. In rural areas, you're going to see them serviced by service providers, where a service provider comes in and provides the apheresis service to the local hospital, or they ship those patients to a larger medical university setting where they have those procedures available.
That's good to know. What else do you think that physicians who are working with patients who might need phoresis or patients who might be undergoing phoresis or having that presented to them as a treatment option, what kind of things do you think someone who's not directly involved with the planning and execution of the treatment protocol should know that we haven't already hit on?
Well, I think the main thing is vascular access, and don't immediately jump to a central line without assessing veins. And in the recent 2 or 3 years, ultrasound guided placement of IV catheters have become more and more popular and readily available. It's a skill set that is specific for placing, IV catheters, but if they don't immediately jump to a central line, I think it's better for the patient. We believe in doing no harm. And that's ASPA, that's my company, that's nursing in general. We believe in doing no harm. And to me, a central line is opening up the patient to harm and infection. And if you can take a step back and think, okay, do we have the capabilities of doing this peripherally? Do we have ultrasound capabilities? Can we place a catheter with an ultrasound versus sticking, the white
Yeah, like a
tube of
tunnel
stuff
cath or an
in?
HD cath or.
Exactly. I think that's a thing to keep in mind. Also, know that what the costs are between both.
Yeah, it can be very expensive. So if people want to find you, are you online anywhere? Should they look you up, email?
I do not have a website. I am not online, but they can reach me through my company. My email address is lori.harada, and you'll have my name up there at terumobct.com. They can easily email me and reach me that way.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I think I learned a few things about paresis, and it's definitely a useful tool to have in the toolkit for a lot of our
It
autoimmune
is.
neurologic conditions.
It is. It's a useful tool. Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael. It was a pleasure.
Thank you again to Lori today for teaching us all a little bit more about aphoresis. And I will include her email in the show notes for today if you ever want to reach her for finding some more information about aphoresis. If you enjoyed this podcast, please do leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This helps with getting the show noticed, and it just makes me feel nice to hear from you. So please be sure to subscribe for future episodes, and you can reach me on Twitter at Dr. Kentris, that's DrKentris, or by email at theneurotransmitterspodcast@gmail.com with any questions or show suggestions. See you next time.